This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad. And the federal budget finally comes down tomorrow, putting an end to the Prime Minister's multi-billion dollar promise roadshow. Has he left anything unannounced? Will there be any surprises as there were in Ontario's provincial budget? Anything for the older demographic? Will there be money for the new disability benefit? It was passed into law last summer, but so far, no check is in the mail. And, however, the Canada Carbon Tax, Carbon Rebate, excuse me, it's not a tax, will land in your bank account today after that contentious increase to the carbon price on April the 1st. Most Ontarians will receive at least $140 per quarter. That's up from $122 last year. Albertans will get an average of $450 for a family of four. So will that quell the opposition to the increases at the gas pumps and for fuel? And what about the criticism that this is a tax and an income redistribution program? Let's start there. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Rudy Boutignol, president of the CARP, the Canadian Association of Retired Persons, CARP, Peter Mugridge, senior editor of Zoomer Magazine, and Lauren Bozanoff, president of the Forum Research Group. Hello and welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. Good so, Lauren, let's start with you talking about this carbon tax. What have you found in polling and talking to people?
Well, first of all, look at the context. The Tories are way, way ahead in the polls. They're about 44%. They're looking at a majority of a 200-plus seats. The Liberals are back at 24. So the Liberals really have their backs against the wall. And the carbon tax is part of that, and the rebate is part of the fix for that problem they have with the carbon tax.
But is it a fix, Rudy?
I don't think so. I live in British Columbia, so we don't see a rebate. It's gas prices there are really, really high. So I'm not sure where the gas
over what, $2 a liter?
Last week I think it was about $2.15 for regular.
Wow. Oh, go ahead. Yes.
So, you know, I don't look at my my income tax forms all regularly, but every time I go to fill up, I sure see the increase. And I still don't understand how it's not a tax. I mean, it's not like it's voluntary. We have to pay for it. It is a tax, like all the other taxes at the gas pump.
And what are CARP members saying about it?
Well, CARP members are really concerned about financial security. And with many of our members being on income, fixed incomes, everything just adds to the cost of living, including gas. And for members that are not in cities where an automobile becomes a really important lifeline to the community, they see that price at the gas pump every time they fill up.
And having $140, well, not in BC, but having $140, I have some numbers on averages, but be $140 and a much smaller number for the second adult in the household if there is a person. Peter, your sense of how people are receiving it and, what they make of the Liberals thinking that this is going to save their bacon on
The rebrand it'll come into your account as the carbon rebate rather than a government transfer, right? So they're counting on that. I mean, they do say that 80% of Canadians get back more from the rebate than they pay in you know, taxes on gasoline and energy and electricity. But I don't know. I really wonder where those numbers come from, because I don't think I do. And, you know, it seems like in a perfect world, maybe we would get more, or maybe based on projections. But on actual outlay, I think we're behind on it. And, you know, there's just not numbers to back it up yet.
That's right. And I wonder, you know, it's mostly direct deposit, and there's a psychological difference, I think, especially for people who remember getting physical checks. There's a psychological difference between getting a physical check and seeing who it's from and just having something bunged in your bank account that you will look at, you know, when you do your monthly accounts or whatever.
I think that's the reminder you see at the gas pump. You know, that one you see every time you fill up. And at least before, when you got a check, you sort of, I see who this is from and what it's for, and I'll deposit it. I still don't know how those numbers work. I do read regularly and try to figure out how is this carbon tax revenue neutral, and I just don't see it.
And Lauren, you know, speaking to the politics of it, last week we saw the NDP leader Jagmeet Singh come out against a carbon tax for individuals. He said, yes, tax the big polluters, but he said that he gets how not everybody can change their mode of transportation. You know, not everybody can afford a Tesla, really. And not everybody can change their heating. And is that impactful, Lauren?
You know what? Even among the NDP supporters, there is some opposition to the carbon tax. There's still more NDP support it than oppose it, but there is a substantial number. And I think I think Singh was getting cold feet over this whole issue. He seems to have found himself after that, but last week he was getting pretty nervous over this whole thing.
Okay, well, there you go. Proof positive. Is there anything, Rudy, in the roadshow that really caught your attention? And can you think of something that was not in the roadshow that maybe might be there as a little surprise goodie?
Well, I think the you know, the disability benefit program. I think that's really essential. Canadians have wanted it. I know that our members want it. But this was something that was announced into law or passed into law last year. And here we are a year later, and it's another announcement. And I think it's a problem with this government. I think a lot of people have tuned out these announcements. In other words, you know, this government's been good at announcing but not implementing, promising lots of stuff, and then people are waiting like, where's the beef?
And generally speaking, you have to reelect them once, if not twice.
That's right.
For them to make good on anything, Peter.
That's right, because this is from a 2020 promise, I think. So we've had one election since and maybe a second before it gets implemented, right? The disability credit. But I think it's going to be another very expensive program, and I don't think this budget's going to be a cost saving budget. And I don't think we're going to see, other than housing, we're not going to see big ticket programs, and we might have to wait another year for it.
Well, if it comes, you know, if those polls bear out, we will not be reelecting the Liberal government. Anything can happen between now and the next election. And Lauren, there was polling that showed that most Canadians, you know, whether they have a disability or not, are very much in favor of this benefit.
You know what? It's hard to be against something like this. It's almost a motherhood issue, and how could you be against it? So they are supportive of it. The key issue, though, is are they willing to pay for it? And the whole problem with the Liberals seems to be they have all these great ideas, they make all these announcements, but they can't find anybody to pay for it. And then then they keep making the same announcement a year later after delaying the program. But eventually, you know, that's going to get caught up to them. Either they're going to have to actually do something and launch a program and then find someone to pay for it, or they're going to look like they're just making announcements.
Yeah, you know, Peter just cited housing. Most of these announcements have to do with housing. obviously they're trying to appeal to a younger demographic, but and there's this food program, which, again, it's the kind of thing, as Lauren points out, that, you know, you can't be against feeding school children who are hungry. But all of these things, they seem to be wading into areas where they need the provinces to come on board, and the provinces are not necessarily on board. I don't know if people focus on that or not. Rudy, what do you think?
I'm not sure if people focus on it, but I think that that's the crux of the problem in implementation. A lot of these things are provincial jurisdiction, and unless you get the provinces on board, it's not going to happen. You know, in terms of the housing, for instance, a lot of the issues around housing, really, it's the provinces that control that. Cities are the wards of the province, and a lot of building restrictions come from municipal legislation. So you have to get the provinces on board to implement any of these. But I think it suits the federal government. They can announce it, and then, you know, say that it's in discussions with the provinces, which are going nowhere.
I would think it is an issue, Peter, for Zoomers, they're looking at their kids, and their kids can't afford a home, let alone a home close to where their parents live.
Absolutely. And also, they're often helping out their kids with down payments as well, right? So it is an issue that certainly speaks to the younger generations, but it also, you know, it will be taken, you know, it'll be enthusiastically, endorsed by older voters who have kids in the game. But for older voters who don't have kids, grandkids, this is falling flat. Like, it's not going to speak to them at all.
Yes. Yeah. As an older voter who doesn't have kids or grandkids, but, you know, again, I'm pretty skeptical about most of it. But I remember being quite pleasantly surprised when the provincial budget came down and there was suddenly all this money for home care, which we really need. Mm-hmm. It was pretty well received, even though, interestingly, the doctors that I speak to saying, well, we have to wait and see how that money is going to flow and how it's going to be spent. So I'm wondering if the federal government sort of took a look and said, that strategy was good for them. Maybe we should do something similar.
Well, it's easier for the province to do it because it's their jurisdiction. So when the Ontario budget came out, there were some really good things there for CARP members. In fact, we sent a letter to the Premier to thank them for implementing some of the ideas that CARP has been pushing for a number of years. So that's good for the province. But in terms of the federal government, they can announce the program, but how do they enact it until they get the provincial government on board? And that's what slows everything down, amongst other things. But this government, I've sort of tuned out these announcements, thinking of, you know, what's next? Are they going to offer a pony for every family? They might as well, because it's all in fantasy land as far as their track record's concerned.
I'm going to give the numbers out again, people, if you have anything to say about this, if you have any expectations about what will be coming out in tomorrow's budget. If you, like Rudy, have tuned out these announcements, I want to know. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And moving right along, and I'm probably a bit of a contrarian on this, but there was a story in the Toronto Star about how most foreign-trained nurses are not working in their professions. And the thing that it cited was that the cost of getting the training that you need and even taking the exams and all of that. Now, first of all, I've again talked with my medical panel about relying on foreign trained people, and it's problematic, especially if they come from places that need them. That's one thing. But my thought is, you know, these professionals, they are economic migrants. They're not refugees. And if you're an economic migrant, we know all the stories of people who arrived in this country with very small amounts of money, but they come with, I mean, they understand that what the deal is going to be if they're an economic migrant. So am I being too harsh to say, well, you know, we do have a shortage of nurses, but shouldn't they be prepared for these costs?
I don't think you're being harsh. You know, myself and my family were economic migrants from post-war Italy. We arrived on the boat and we made our way through hard work and everything. Now, times have changed since then, and I think that that's important to keep in mind. But in terms of qualifying for a professional through a professional college like nurses, they're there for a reason, to uphold certain standards. And so I think some of the mitigating factors, like lowering registration fees to requalify, I think that's a good thing because we need nurses. I also read about lowering the language proficiency, and that kind of gave me pause thinking, you know, I think being able to read and write in English would be very important in terms of working as a healthcare professional in a hospital where reading instructions and prescriptions is vital.
Well, even not in a hospital, and I have to say I was quite recently in the hospital, and there were a lot of foreign-born nurses. There were a lot of very young, well, by my standards, very young women from Korea. That seemed to be the biggest group. But there were a lot of foreign-born nurses, and obviously they were extremely competent. But again, you know, I don't know about, you know, we talk about incentives, so maybe lowering a registration fee would be good, but I'm not sure that this focus is the right kind of focus, Peter.
No, and it's not, nor is it going to solve the issue, right? Like how many are there? I think they say there are 5,000 in the province now, and they're having a hard time identifying who, you know, which ones have the right credentials and which are just, you know, saying they're nurses on their forms. And I think, you know, like the you have to address why you know, there aren't more nurses, and it's resources, it's making the job better, it's, you know, it's lowering the burnout rates, the foreign nurses are a nice kind of like backup measure, but we really need to make the job, you know, more appealing to Canadians right now, and that'll solve the shortage.
Yeah. I mean, again, going back to my recent hospital experience, there were also some, again, very young nurses who were trained up north, and they were great.
Yeah, I think the, you know, the people that you see dedicating themselves to healthcare, particularly in hospitals, they work really hard. They're dedicated. I'm not sure what the various qualifications are. I assume they're qualified in order to be working there, but you know, the crisis that we've hit, all of a sudden with housing crisis and primary care and healthcare in general, has been totally exacerbated by this surge in temporary foreign workers. You know, and the government itself lost track of how many people were actually in Canada, and they realized last year that, oh, we missed a million of them. And all of a sudden you have, 2.7 million temporary foreign workers and international students who also need housing and they need health care, and we've not planned for it. And as an economic migrant, someone who came from another country, neither English nor French, my family and I came when the government was prepared. They had the right numbers and they could accommodate and absorb immigration and provide people a good chance to get started, you know, to reasonable rent and job opportunities. We've unleashed these numbers of temporary foreign workers and students without preparing, giving them a chance at success.
Lauren, I mean, we all say that the immigration system is a mess. What are you finding in polling?
Well, I think there's concern over the the number of immigrants in the country and the fact that the government did lose track of them. But just going back to the issue of the nurses, you know, the self-regulated health colleges have had a history of having high standards for applicants educated outside the country. And to deal with that, there's an office. I just had learned about this very, very recently. It's called the Office of the Fairness Commissioner. It's an Ontario government agency. And they look at whether the standards are appropriate that the colleges are applying to foreign-educated professionals.
Good to know. Good to know. But one of the things that, you know, I read about is that the problems with the system, the problems with the government losing track of foreign workers and foreign students is kind of undermining the consensus that Canadians have that immigration is a good thing. Lauren, have you seen evidence of that?
That's, I think, something we'll see in a longer term rather than a short term type of issue. That's a longer term thing. You know, we have a lot of immigrants in the country. A lot of Canadians have come from all over the world and their families. So we have a large immigrant database now, or base of newcomers, first, second, third generation, and so forth. So there is support among those groups, but I think over time, as these excessive numbers occur, there's going to be pushback on the immigration levels.
Yeah. I'm looking at the clock. It's time to wrap things up. We're going to give everybody 20 seconds, starting with Peter. What are you looking for or hoping for tomorrow in that budget?
Well, I'm hoping for spending restraint. I hope they don't keep, you know, overshooting the what their promises were on spending. And let's have a common sense budget for once and get the country back on track fiscally.
Okay, Rudy?
Pretty much the same thing with me, to start working on lowering the deficit in order to kind of ease the inflation pressures. I think inflation is a really difficult thing for economies to get a hold of, and restraining spending would be a good start.
Okay. Lauren, what about you? Last word to you.
Well, this is a pre-election budget. Probably we have election before the next budget. So it's a pre-election budget. There's going to be the temptation for a lot of goodies in that budget because of that. Let's hope they don't go for that temptation.
Okay, well, faint hope is what I say. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Peter Muggeridge, Rudy Boutignol, and Lauren Bozanoff. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Libby.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, we will talk about the latest in Israel and the Middle East after that Iranian attack on Saturday night. Shocking. When we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Now to the Middle East. There is consensus that Saturday's Iranian attack on Israel was unprecedented and changed the unwritten rules of engagement in the Middle East. Thank goodness it caused minimal damage and only one casualty that we know of. According to Barak Ravid at Axios, Iran launched nearly 350 attack drones and missiles against Israel, most of which were intercepted outside of Israeli airspace by Israeli, U.S., British, French, Jordanian, and Saudi forces. Well, now these allies are urging Benjamin Netanyahu's government not to rush into a retaliation. Also, according to Axios, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has told his American counterpart that Israel cannot allow ballistic missiles to be launched against its territory without a response. And the Times of Israel says the War Cabinet is looking for a response that will be, quote, painful but not spark a full-scale war. It is an inflection point and a crossroads and a very dangerous time. Let me give the numbers out. 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. 4740. And let's bring in Dr. Amos Giora, professor of law at the University of Utah and a former legal advisor to the IDF in Gaza. Martin Himmel, award-winning investigative documentary filmmaker, and Vivian Berkovich, a former ambassador of Canada to Israel. Welcome, all of you. Thanks for joining. And you're all in Israel, I gather.
Pleasure to be here.
Yes.
Okay, well,
pleasure to be home in Israel and a pleasure to be on your show.
Okay, well, thank you, Amos. Martin, what was it like on Saturday night?
Well, it was for me personally, it was a real surrealistic experience. I mean, at 7 o'clock in the morning, I had to be at Echolot Hospital for the birth of my third grandson. And so you can imagine that with what was going on. I mean, it was a surrealistic experience. We knew at 11:30 at night that a couple hundred of these mini drones armed with explosives were on their way, and that several hours after that, there was going to be missiles. It was like an attack in slow motion, and bracing to be the response, and the uncertainty of knowing what the response was going to be was really, really amplified. In the end, it was a very impressive response, and I managed to make it for the birth of my third granddaughter. So in that sense, it all turned out well.
Well, yeah. So she's fine, and your daughter is fine. Is it your daughter's or your son's?
It's my daughter's third child.
Yes. Okay. Well, congratulations, Mazal Tov.
Thank you.
It must have been incredibly stressful. I can't even imagine, you know, preparing to give birth in that circumstance.
That's right. We didn't know until the last minute. It was a C-section, so we didn't know the last minute if it was going to happen or not, because the hospitals were bracing for a lot of things. But everything turned out well. It turned out well for me, and it turned out well for this country.
Well, yes. Vivian Berkovich, where were you, and what was your reaction initially?
So, hi, Martin, by the way. Nice to hear your voice.
Hi.
So I was in Tel Aviv, and it's been a weird time because, you know, they've been rattling the sabers and, you know, banging the drums for 10 days, 2 weeks tomorrow, that Israel attacked the IRGC building, whatever it was, in Damascus. So, you know, Iran's been threatening. It's been like, you know, are they going to do it abroad? Are they going to hit Israel? They ended up deciding, and we knew it was coming. You know, they kept saying 24 to 48 hours. And then on Saturday night, I was actually in Tel Aviv at the rally in support of the hostages, that's what we call Hostage Square. And you know, John Androsic, Five for Fighting, had just performed, and it was great. And then everybody gets the same message at the same time from the Home Front Command saying, basically, get home. There's going to be an imminent attack, you know, 24 to 48 hours, which turned out to be very imminent. So I went home. In Tel Aviv, we had no sirens. It was, as Martin said, it was totally surreal. You're watching on TV, you're hearing these reports of these swarms of drones coming towards you, and then waves of drones. There's a first wave, there's a second wave, there's all kinds of missiles. And we didn't know early on that there's going to be this kind of incredible multilateral Air Force cooperation. I mean, it's unprecedented. You know, you think of Jordanians and Saudis scrambling to prevent, you know, attack weapons going to Israel. It's just crazy, right? So, and then we're watching it live. Like, we're watching these live kind of scrambles on TV. It was crazy. Jerusalem was a lot nuttier. They had a lot of sirens. There were places where it was a lot crazier. But, you know, here in Tel Aviv, it was quiet.
Well, I mean, Jordan and Saudi Arabia are not exactly enamored of Iran either. Amos, what's your reaction to this huge cooperation? Most of those missiles and drones were shot down before they hit Israeli airspace. And what do you think, what kind of a debt or what does Israel owe to those allies as a result of that?
Interesting question, your last one. I think President Biden put it best, or at least on his behalf, it was said that President Biden said to Netanyahu, we support you defensively, but don't translate that into supporting you offensively. And I think that's a clear message to Netanyahu that the United States, England, France, Jordan, and even, as I understand from the other two distinguished guests, also Saudi Arabia, were involved in shooting down the drones. I mean, everybody for their own reasons. But I think Netanyahu is in a battle here between his extremists, who are two members of his ministry, of his government, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are calling on Israel to do whatever these two fanatics want. And he's got Gantz and Eisenkot, who I would like to think are whispering sounds of sanity and reasonableness. And Netanyahu needs to figure out not only the geopolitics of this, but he's also locked in battle here politically with you know, there will be elections here at some point. He's been talking about Iran, and I think it's also we need to give credit to where credit is due. For the past year or so, the anti-government forces have been labeled as traitors, anarchists, and God knows what else. And at the end of the day, those who protected Israel are exactly those who have been targeted by the government and its allies as traitors and anarchists and whatever else. They protected Israel. They saved Israel. I think we need to be very honest about who at the end of the day protects Israel and defends Israel. And that's part of this very, very complicated equation. So we can talk about Iran, you know, for hours. But the more compelling question is not only the geopolitics of the Middle East, but also the politics of Israel. Put all that into a blender and we could sit here, you know, for hours. But it is a very complicated domestically and internationally. And I remind all of us that according to, you know, to the New York Times, there are American elections in November. And how Biden and plays this or interacts with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party is also a piece of this puzzle.
Vivian, according to Axios, which I think is a very, very reliable source, Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, told his U.S. counterpart that Israel has to retaliate, that they can't just let this go by, even though Iran said, okay, we're done. Don't worry about it. So, first of all, do you believe that that's what happened? And do you think that given the support that Israel got from the allies, that it can just turn around and ignore all that advice?
Well, I mean, like everything, it's complicated. Right before I got on the phone to talk to you and your other guests, you know, I got a blast on one of my many WhatsApp groups telling me that Bibi has just summoned all of the opposition leaders to the IDF headquarters in Tel Aviv called Kiria for an urgent meeting. So we know that the war cabinet was meeting early this afternoon. What that suggests is some kind of decision has been made. There is a sense that they do intend to strike. And the calculation that I've been reading and hearing today is they intend to strike in a way that Israel thinks will be enough to sort of send a message that you don't do that kind of thing, but not enough to escalate. And on that last point, you know, I can have to say I and I know many Israelis are not brimming with confidence in the judgment of the current leadership, because, you know, they've made some pretty grave errors. And I think that one of those was when they chose to bomb Damascus 2 weeks ago. Had they thought that there would be this kind of response from Iran, I'm going to suggest that they would not have done that. They would not have taken that action 2 weeks ago. There's a kind of smugness that seems to permeate the upper levels of leadership here. And, you know, it led to October 7th. We have the Damascus thing now. We have enough on our plate. But I'm concerned that for the domestic political reasons and also geopolitical, you know, you don't tell a government like Benjamin Netanyahu, okay, now everything worked out fine. Now sit down and be a good boy and don't fight back. That is not the way to talk to a guy like Bibi.
Martin,
and that's what Biden's been doing.
Martin, what's your view of the retaliation question and Israel's debt to the allies?
Well, I think that there's a much wider picture here, and that is
Having those allies, you'll really need them if you're going to go after Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Israel might have to go after Hezbollah in Lebanon because they have to return the inhabitants to the north. You will really need that support, especially if Iran tries to intervene. And you're not going to keep it if you're just going to launch some sort of mediocre attack at this stage. It's going to inflame that issue. And then the other thing is, you will need them in order to get Israel back economically. You need better ties. You need better relations. Israel's hurting economically from everything that's going on here. I think that if Israel had some magic solution that it's going to make a game changer by maybe removing the nuclear threat or something like that, that would be a perfect reason to go in at this stage. But anything smaller that's just trying to say, don't hit us again, is just going to backfire, because I can tell you some scenarios that are really going to get Israel into trouble. Let's say they hit some military bases, et cetera, in Saudi Arabia, and then the Iranians decide, why hit Israel? I'm going to hit the Saudi Arabians. I'm going to hit the Emiratis. They were part of this. And then you're going to have a really big problem, because these guys came out and helped you, and they became the subject of attacks, and they may not have the weaponry and the defense to thwart such attacks. So what are you going to do then? And that's why I think the wider picture is much, much more important. If Israel doesn't have a game-changing operation in its pocket, it's better not to attack now. If it does, that might be a different situation.
Amos, do you agree?
Yeah, I don't trust Netanyahu as far as I can throw him, and I'm in pretty good shape. And I worry about his judgment, and I worry about that in order to placate the extreme right wing of his government, that he may indeed undertake something that I think would be strategically harmful. I also need to add, I think you know, I don't know if your two other guests know, I was Yoav Gallant's legal advisor when we both served in the Gaza Strip. I think one needs to be careful with what Yoav says for public rhetoric and what he genuinely means. I think that he understands, I think Martin's right here, that there are strategic limits into what Israel can do. But again, the interaction between the geopolitics and the politics is extremely complicated, and it's exacerbated by the fact that Netanyahu has a criminal trial dangling over his head. And again, as I said earlier, there are elections forthcoming here at some point. That's why whatever he does, chooses to do, he needs to understand, or somebody needs to explain to him. I think that's, and the person who needs to do that is President Biden. And if you were to include Biden on this call, I would have one piece of advice to Biden. And that is, when you speak to Netanyahu, speak Hebrew, don't speak English. Because when Biden speaks to Bibi, Bibi interprets it how it's convenient for him. And there's a difference between speaking to Israelis, what we call in Hebrew, duguri, which is straight to the point, and it's compared to what, you know, speaking politely.
Netanyahu's English is pretty good. But just before I move along to Vivian Amos, do you believe the Axios report that Gallant told Austin that Israel can't let this go without retaliation?
Yeah, again, what I just said earlier, do I believe he said it? Yes. Does that translate into something operational? We'll see, but never say never. But I think Yoav is more careful. Again, I served as his legal advisor. He's more careful and cautious than Netanyahu.
Well, yeah, that's okay. No comment on that. Vivian, one of the things that I find fascinating about this was that before this attack, most of the allies, they were really down on Israel and its conduct of the war in Gaza. And this seems to have changed that equation almost entirely. And part of what I wonder at is, wow, you know, Netanyahu really has many, many lives.
No kidding. It does seem to have, temporarily at least refocused, the allies. I don't think that it means that they're happy with the way that Bibi has been conducting the war in Gaza. But it means that something more critical, urgent, and imperative kind of superseded whatever's going on in Gaza. You know, the possibility of a direct, well, reality as we know now, of a direct Iranian attack for the first time since the state of Israel was established. And without the allied intervention, it could have been pretty catastrophic. Israel's defense capabilities with respect to the weapons that were targeting Israel from Iran, Israel's defense capabilities are limited. It would not have been a successful operation. Over 99% of those weapons intercepted had the Allies not been involved. So I think that you know, the Allies are happy that it seems to have been neutralized for a day, right? This cauldron. Iran says, okay, we're happy, we're good, victory for us. But now the wild card is Israel. And as Martin said, you know, if Israel decides to go and do something kind of, you know, just for the sake of, I think that's not advisable, let's put it that way. And as, you know, he was talking about Lebanon, and I've been saying in interviews the last few days, like, we have more than enough on our plate as it is. We really don't have the bandwidth to assume more risk. We got enough. And Iran's a wild card. And again, this leadership, all of it, intelligence, Mossad, army intelligence, and the government leadership have demonstrated on October 7th and on many occasions since that they do not have what I would consider to be solid judgment.
And Martin, you know, I don't know if you've been reading Iranian press, but their attack was shown to be a failure. Is there any sense that there's a recognition of that?
I'm sure in the leadership echelons and the military echelons in Iran, they see it full well. I think that they are very sophisticated. They are very bright, and they're very mature in their approach on how to deal with international issues. And they think about things many times. They might be very extreme in their ideology and very extreme in their religious fanaticism, but they're very, very smart when it comes to international politics. After all, they're on the verge of having a nuclear bomb, and despite everything that's been going on, and that's a key interest for them. So I'm sure they realize that their military potential to strike Israel is far from where it should be in order to really pose a very serious threat to Israel. And they also know full well that their defenses against Israeli attacks are minimal to none, and they are very, very exposed. So I think that this was a big wake-up call for them, and they are going to use prudence before they try something like that again. That is why I say the deterrence has already been shown when it comes to something like a tit-for-tat or a medium type of attack. It's also been shown that if Israel goes against Hezbollah, they'll think five times before sending Iranian rockets at Israel, because they realize that Israel, they are exposed to Israeli attack. So why exacerbate the situation with these allies that are so crucial for anything in Lebanon? There's no reason for it, except, as your guest said, the Prime Minister Netanyahu has got to placate the fanatical right in Israel, and I hope it doesn't come to that.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. I'm just going to quickly ask our other two panelists if I mean, it's we'll probably find the real answer very soon, but Amos, do you think there will be a retaliation soon?
I think if there is, I would like to think that it'll be more strategic than force. And there are ways to go about doing this. We could have a whole different conversation, how to have a strategic response without a whole lot of noise. And I think that yeah, might be better suited. But again, what worries me the most, more than anything else, is Bibi Netanyahu's judgment. That is what keeps me up at night.
Vivian Berkovich, do you think that retaliation will happen?
I agree with what Amos said. I do think that there will be some retaliation, and I hope that it's very, you know, kind of pinpoint, focused, smart, and quiet, like in the old days. You know, in recent years, we've had the Mossad and others coming out and sort of, you know, telling and bragging about kind of how great their accomplishments of their attacks. We need to go back to the old days where it was quiet by stealth, and the job just got done. Okay. But I do think that there's something in the works. I do.
Okay. Thank you so much, Vivian Berkovich, Martin Himmel, and Amos Giora. Thanks so much for your insight.
Thank you.
Okay, we are taking a break, people. And when we come back, it's National Volunteer Week, and I would love to hear from people on what kind of volunteer work they do or they did. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740, and we'll be right back with that.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. It's National Volunteer Week, and the latest numbers we have are from 2018 that showed that 79% of Canadians 15 and older took part in some form of volunteer work. They contributed about 2.5 billion, that's billion with a B, hours, worth approximately $55 billion. The oldest Canadians spent the most hours volunteering. And women from baby boomer and millennial generations are more likely to volunteer than men from the same age group. So I'd like to know, do you volunteer? Have you volunteered in the past? What kind of thing do you do? Numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Sharon Avery, President and CEO of the Toronto Foundation, and Joanne McKiernan, who is the Executive Director of Volunteer Toronto. Thanks for joining us. Hello.
Hi there.
Let's begin with Joanne. And one of the things that we keep hearing is that volunteering really fell off during the pandemic. Has it recovered at all?
Yeah, it's been a challenging time for all of us to stay connected, hasn't it been? And so during this time, we did see a surge of folks interested in supporting frontline volunteerism. But as we get back to the pressure of work and hybrid activities, and as folks are trying to create those social reconnections, we have seen a drop in volunteerism from about 37% of Torontonians to 25%. We know that folks are feeling a bit lonelier, less connected, and they're in need of some spark to encourage participation in community activities.
Well, it's a bit ironic because volunteering is one of the things that will make you feel connected, Sharon.
Absolutely. As we've seen a drop in connectivity, we see a drop in people's sense of quality of life. And we know that the more people are involved in their community, the more pleasure and joy and that connectedness brings to them. So absolutely, I think it's an essential ingredient for happiness.
I'm going to take a call from Bernice in Hamilton. Hello, Bernice.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm fine. Please go ahead. Tell us about your volunteer experience.
Well, I was a teacher for 31 years, and when I retired, I was kind of lost. So I drove for Meals on Wheels for 5 years, and it was interesting. It was kind of sad because for some of these people, you're the only contact they have with the outside world. And when you come to visit them, they just want to talk and talk and talk because they're lonely. And you can't stay for that long because you've got a specific time level to get this done in. I can't do it anymore because now I have multiple sclerosis, so I'm stuck at home.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, life's been good, no problems.
Well, Bernice, thanks for sharing that, and it shows how important that work is. I mean, it is a bit sad, but social isolation is deadly, especially among people who are more housebound. Bernice, thanks so much for telling us that. That's one of the things that a lot of people do. They drive for Meals on Wheels. Sometimes they drive cancer patients. Joanne, what are some of the other common things that people take on? Joanne? Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm having difficulty with my audio. I might have to ask Sharon to jump in for me.
Okay, Sharon, go ahead.
Well, I definitely think we've actually been offering grants to inspire people to get involved. And so I think that there's a lot of neat things that happen at the neighborhood level, street parties and clubs that people join. A lot of the ways that we get seniors engaged is through their local community centers, craft and exercise programs. And then a lot of folks are volunteering at food centers and out of the cold programs. And so these are all ways we can connect, as you say, to these folks that find themselves severely isolated. We saw in our research that almost a million Torontonians felt lonely in the last 3 to 4 days.
Wow. And tell us a bit more about these micro grants.
So we had launched a whole report on loneliness back in the fall with Volunteer Toronto and other partners. And as part of that, we kind of incited the desire for people to be optimistic about their city and get back involved. And one of the ways we hope to create some incentive was to launch this microgrants program. We had 275 groups apply for just small amounts of funding to help them do neat things that it got them back involved in community again, community gardens, historical walking tours, all kinds of neat things. And so we've just announced with Volunteer Toronto the support of 35 different groups who are doing all kinds of neat things in neighborhoods like Rexdale, South Parkdale, East Scarborough, and Willowdale, and others, everything in between.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Judy in Toronto. Hello, Judy.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I was a volunteer at the hospital near where I grew up in Richmond Hill for years. And that is where I met my now ex-husband. But I enjoyed that experience. I did it for about 5 years. And I did it maybe 12 hours a day to get out of an unhappy at-home situation. But it's something that I wished I could have done and got paid for it.
Okay, thank you for that. I'll take one from David in Georgetown. Hi, David. What was your or is your volunteer experience?
So I did quite a bit of volunteer work with Special Olympics. I was a coach in the sport of curling. And started a program up in this area. And I think working with, I don't like to call them disabled, but alter-abled people was just absolutely wonderful. It was just such a joy to work with them. Unfortunately, I had to stop. But I took on another volunteer position with Toronto Hospice. And just as a peer bereavement person, I've done some groups. And that has got to be one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done. You know, just to help people who have suffered losses. And it helps you, actually, you know, because you've suffered a loss, too. And it was just a wonderful experience.
Thank you for that, David. Sounds very important and very rewarding. Appreciate your call. I'm looking at the clock. It's time to wrap things up. But those calls are inspiring. And again, we know that volunteering doesn't just help the people that you're serving, but also the person doing the volunteering. Sharon, what would you like to leave us with in 20 seconds?
Just how inspired I am by your callers, and just encourage others to get out there again. It really is joyful. We see a big connection between volunteering and donating as well. And so there's just so much that folks can do for their communities by getting engaged.
Joanne, only 20 seconds left to you.
I'd love to wish everyone a happy National Volunteer Week. All of your colleagues exemplify how important it is that our contributions help to rebuild social fabric and reinvest in ourselves. So I want to thank everyone for their participation and encourage everyone to find their role in building a stronger and healthier community.
Okay, on that note, we wrap things up. Joanne McKernan and Sharon Avery, thanks so much. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.